Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of Saúde Diversidade, for the first time recorded in English. This is the final episode of the season HIV from Chaos to Cure. Hope is a scientific fact. In this season, Instituto Saúde Diversidade received financial support from the Hope Martin Delaney Collaboratory for HIV Cure Research to produce 5 podcast episodes in Portuguese, the official language of the podcast, and 1 special episode in English.
Through these podcasts, we explore how HIV has affected our society, the scientific response to this unprecedented challenge, and different strategies scientists are developing towards the cure.
In this special episode, we will first understand the remarkable development of HIV treatment since the early days of the epidemic until the present day. We will then discuss why, despite the existence of very effective treatments, people living with HIV and scientists are still passionately hoping to develop a cure. Finally, we will talk about cure strategies and speak with people who have been cured.
To map this journey, we interviewed researchers, healthcare providers, people living with HIV, and a person who has been cured of HIV.
I am Vivian Avelino Silva, infectious disease specialist and researcher and president of the NGO Instituto Saúde Diversidade. I am pleased to have Raif Durazi joining me in this episode. Hi, Raif.
Hi, everyone. I'm Raif Durazi, and I'm so happy to collaborate with you on this journey. Welcome, everyone. I was diagnosed with AIDS in 2012, and since then have become undetectable, a professional bodybuilder, and an HIV advocate, and it's such a huge passion for my life now. So thank you for having me.
I am Françoise Barré-Sinoussi from France, professor at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. I was part of the team that discovered HIV in 1983.
Since the first AIDS cases were reported in 1981, researchers, healthcare providers, patients, and communities have collaborated in a massive effort to understand and control this condition. In this CNN article, Françoise Barré-Sinoussi shared her memories from the announcement of the Nobel Prize granted to her team to recognize its history-changing discovery of HIV in 1983.
The day the Nobel Prize was announced was in Cambodia. When I came back from Cambodia, they did not tell me in advance, but they were at the airport. So when the door opened, I saw all the team dancing, singing with my picture. And I started to cry.
While HIV has posed challenges from both the scientific and the social perspectives, these challenges have also served as encouragement to providers and researchers who decided to dedicate their careers to improve the lives of people living with HIV. We interviewed Monica Gandhi, infectious diseases clinician and researcher, who explained how HIV influenced her path.
I am a longstanding HIV doctor, actually, and I always wanted to go into HIV since I was in high school because I was growing up in the 80s, and so I grew up with the epidemic and became very interested in stigmatized populations. I had friends who were gay in high school who came out, and I grew up in a place that it was very difficult for them, and a lot of stigma. And I was very interested in working on this infection in terms of destigmatizing it, and also the policy implications, the fact that infectious disease and poverty are intermingled, and very interested in kind of the social justice aspect of the infection. And then I happened to love infectious disease. So I did go into infectious disease after my residency as a fellowship, and then focused more on HIV, both as a clinician and as a researcher.
Healthcare providers and researchers have been moved by the social aspects of the HIV epidemic, and many have also incorporated activism into their daily work, as Stephen Deeks, HIV clinician and researcher, told us in his testimonial.
So it was something that, you know, I experienced, you know, in a very big way in my training. And a critical thing for me was seeing some people with HIV in the outpatient setting. These were generally young, healthy people, fully engaged in their care, strong activists. And I sort of got sucked into their world and became basically an HIV AIDS activist. We have a research collaboration that is really tied to our community in a way that I just find just incredibly engaging and exciting, and we're never bored.
In 1987, AZT became the first drug approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for treating HIV. The initial treatments were not very effective in controlling the virus, and some of the medications caused serious side effects.
In the beginning, we really didn't have effective treatments. Then we had some early treatments that were highly toxic, so they caused many, many side effects, and they were only partially effective at controlling HIV.
This was Thomas J. Villa, a business executive who has been living with HIV for more than 20 years, telling us how antiretroviral treatment worked in the early days. But over time, therapies evolved, medications became more effective and tolerable, and a big change happened in 1996. Today, people living with HIV who can access antiretroviral treatment can live a long and healthy life, as our interviewees explain here.
The big change, of course, came in January of 1996, when the world changed in like a 10-minute presentation at a major meeting, where we saw for the first time that if you took one drug, nothing happened. Two drugs, something happened. Three drugs, the whole world changed. And we learned then that we can suppress the virus. And so for the past, you know, 25 years or so, we have been perfecting that approach.
Sort of amazing to think of that trajectory, because I started as an intern in 1996 as a medical intern, and that was right when the therapies were changing, and it was going from a death sentence essentially to a infection that we could control. And I watched that sort of people essentially coming back to life. And it was an incredible amount of progress, but it used to be so hard. And even at the beginning of the therapies, they were really hard to take. There were a lot of side effects. And now we have long-acting antiretroviral therapies. We've made such progress. We've had such a trajectory from no oral medications, hard to take oral medications, easier to take oral medications, still for some people hard to take a pill every day, and now an injectable you can give every 8 weeks.
By 1996, we saw the introduction of combination antiretroviral therapy, so multiple medications in one pill. Well, initially it was separate pills, but now it's all together in one pill, two or three, or sometimes even four medications in one pill. And these are highly effective to control HIV. So today HIV is really a, rather than what it was initially, which was a death sentence, really. I mean, in the early days, today it's a manageable chronic disease, and people living with HIV who have access to this therapy and who take it regularly as directed and have an undetectable viral load as a result can live a long and healthy life.
Antiretroviral therapies have evolved and transformed HIV treatment, but there's more. Antiretrovirals have also transformed the way we prevent HIV transmission. These medications can be used by people who don't live with HIV and have had a potential exposure to the virus, if taken up to 72 hours after exposure. This is the so-called post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP.
That's right. And people who don't live with HIV who have recurrent risk of exposure to the virus can use antiretrovirals on a daily basis or on demand as a pre-exposure prophylaxis, known by the acronym PrEP.
And antiretrovirals are also a prevention tool for people who live with HIV. This is called treatment as prevention. Several studies have shown that people living with HIV under antiretroviral treatment with undetectable viral load for more than 6 months do not transmit HIV sexually, even in condomless sex. That concept is also known as undetectable equals untransmittable, or U equals U.
Let's not forget that antiretrovirals have also been used for many years to prevent HIV transmission from a pregnant person to their children. Alicia Tremel McIntyre, community advocate living with HIV and founder of Positive People Network, shared a bit of her story with us.
Or mother to baby, that's not even a factor anymore. It's an act that has to be done versus a child being perinatally born with it, which they would have gotten it from their parents. But that from back then to now is like non-existent. Mm-hmm. So baby's born is like zero. And that's a great thing. I had my last son, he's 19, he'll be 20 this year. I had him after diagnosis growing in my blood and my body and my fluids, yet he has his own antibodies and has nothing of me. He has my DNA. He looks like me. He's my child, but he doesn't have my virus. How wonderful is that?
Yeah.
I'm no scientist, but that's great.
So today's antiretroviral treatment is very effective, easier to take, and has very few side effects. Antiretrovirals have also revolutionized HIV prevention, but challenges persist.
There's a lot of work to be done. There's a fact that treatment doesn't restore health completely. You go on HIV meds, you shut down the virus, people don't get AIDS. That's straightforward. But there's low-level inflammation, we think. And that's, you know, that's interacting with other factors, a lot of them socioeconomic, that combine result in an excess amount of non-age related morbidity.
Unfortunately, as we live this longer and healthier life, we still deal with a lot of effects, both of HIV and of the medication. So we suffer from higher rates of things like comorbidities, such as cardiovascular disease. We suffer from premature aging and frailty at earlier ages.
In order for the treatment to work, people have to take these drugs every day for decades. And that's asking a lot of the healthcare system and of people. Access, right? These drugs are expensive, although much less so these days. And, you know, you have to basically be in a healthcare system to get it.
The U.S. has very different challenges than other places globally. The U.S. really, it's really seems to be coming down to three major challenges. One is substance use. The second is mental illness, which has been exacerbated during COVID. And the third, increasingly in our larger cities, we have a very high homeless rate. And it is very hard to take medications regularly with housing instability.
Stigma. Stigma is one of the top ones for me. And I say this because in order for a person to go to the doctor to get treatment if they're diagnosed, stigma plays a role in that. They don't want to be seen going to an infectious disease doctor. They don't want to go to a pharmacy because in their mind, everybody knows what they have.
Remaining challenges for controlling HIV include stigma, access to diagnosis and healthcare, retention in care, and drug fatigue. But even for people living with HIV who have access and are adherent to treatment, there may be chronic side effects of medications, low-level replication of HIV in some tissues, and chronic inflammation, which may cause long-term complications. In other words, today's treatment is not the same as a cure.
Could we cure HIV and eliminate those remaining issues? This has been one of the main scientific aspirations in the past 40 years.
I was diagnosed in 1995 with HIV, and I was scared to death because at that point people were dying from the disease itself, and also from the only available drug at the time, AZT. Then the protease inhibitors came out the next year in 96, and I ended up taking those or a combination of different treatments for the next 11 years. And then in 2006, in the middle of the year, I developed acute myeloid leukemia. Yeah, that was very scary. I got the chemo treatments. I was supposed to have four rounds of chemo treatment. Unfortunately, I only received two and a half because during the third round of chemo, I developed a sepsis infection and had to be put into an induced coma. Dr. Hüter, he found 262 possible donors, and he had the idea of looking for a donor who was CCR5 delta 32 negative. CCR5 is a protein that sits on the CD4 cell, the T cell, and it acts as a doorway to enter into the cell, and then allowing the virus to spread and causing HIV. So I got it, and I quit taking my HIV medication on the day of my transplant. And I got the transplant, and by the third month after that, I didn't have any detectable HIV in my blood.
This was Timothy Ray Brown, the first person ever to be cured of HIV, who told the story of his cure process in this interview in 2012.
Timothy Ray Brown, in fact, needed two rounds of bone marrow transplants to get rid of his cancer. and he remained free of HIV until 2020, when he passed away. Stephen Deeks, our interviewee in this episode, was one of the doctors caring for Timothy.
Timothy Brown was very inspiring. Unfortunately, passed away a few years ago from cancer unrelated to the HIV, and he was a lovely man. And now there have been at least 5 cases, people being cured in the way Timothy Brown was, which was a bone marrow transplant.
The second case of HIV cure became known as the London patient, and we had the privilege of interviewing him for this episode.
I'm Avan Castillejo, the London patient. Avan is a young guy who happened to have HIV and happened to have cancer, just like anybody else, but that's me.
Adam went through the same procedures as Timothy Ray Brown and has been cured for both cancer and HIV. He shared with us his feelings of luck, but also the hard times he's gone through.
For me, I never thought I would see cure of the HIV in my lifetime. So when I was given the opportunity to cure my cancer, my HIV, that was like a eureka moment. Like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I win the lottery. Something people don't know is when you are an HIV person and a cancer patient at the same time, opportunities to have a transplant is not available for everyone because the data is not there. Doctors are really worried to embark on that journey because of complications and it's highly risky. In my case, they told me I was 10% survival, 20%. I take 40 pills a day because I have a transplant. I'm a transplantee. I'm a cancer survivor. And some people neglect that when I'm in my HIV cure.
Although bone marrow transplants from CCR5 Delta 32 donors have been able to cure HIV in a few people at this point, this is currently not an approach that can be applied generally to people living with HIV unless they also need the transplant to treat cancer, which was the case for both Timothy and Adam.
The reason for this restriction is because the bone marrow transplant is a highly risky procedure, as Adam mentioned.
But other cure strategies are also under investigation. One of them, known as BlockLock excise, aims to block HIV from reactivating and turn it into a defective virus no longer capable of producing new copies of itself. That's the strategy that's been pursued by the HOPE Collaboratory, one of the 10 research consortia comprising the Martin Delaney Collaboratories for HIV Cure Research.
While a lot of work is still needed, new research projects bring hope to people living with HIV.
So before being a part of HOPE and coming here today, when I heard that we're cured, this was my response. Drug companies create customers, not cures. A cure would take away a customer. That takes away money. But after being here and just been so overwhelmed when I went to Gladstone and saw that they were genuine and sincere and really want to do it. It's like I see it differently. Like it can't happen in my lifetime. Hell, listen, the black president in my lifetime, after that, everything better happen because it can and it will.
So novel research strategies require scientific and financial investments, but they also need study volunteers. Have you ever thought about the importance of study participants in any scientific advancement? Alicia and Thomas shared their thoughts with us.
I am so thankful for trial by error and being that guinea pig to help them to get some better treatment today to where we one pill or a shot. So being able to be here today when so many of my brothers and sisters prior to now didn't have that option because they didn't know what they were dealing with. I'm just so thankful for that.
I have been for the past 10 plus years, I have been what I refer to as a serial participant in HIV clinical research. So I have participated in more than 24 clinical trials, including some that include analytic treatment interruption that are intended to help work towards developing effective cures for HIV. And the reason I do this is because I feel that it's a way for me to put my HIV to use. If I'm going to live with HIV, I'm going to make it work hard. So my participation in HIV clinical trials is not hoping for a cure for me. My participation is sort of trying to pay back what people did over the past 40 years. Lots of other people participated in clinical trials to develop the treatments that allow us today to live a healthy life with HIV. So I'm trying to do something similar in developing, helping to develop a cure or cures.
Study participants are indeed heroes, but Tom mentioned analytic treatment interruption. What is that?
Analytic treatment interruption, sometimes called ATI for short, consists of pausing antiretroviral medication as part of a clinical trial of a potentially curative intervention. During these treatment interruptions, the volunteer is monitored very closely by the research team through laboratory testing and clinical visits to keep them safe. These treatment interruptions are needed to assess whether the investigational treatment had intended effect. They are an essential part of cure studies and also a very challenging one. After all, would you be okay with stopping a medication that you have relied on to stay healthy?
Adam Castillejo has shared his experience in that regard.
So when I stop my medication, I decide to do it in a symbolic day on my birthday. So I say to myself, what is the best present I can give to myself? I will stop my medication. So I stop and I say, that's it. Happy birthday, Adam.
Happy life, Adam. People living with HIV should have the choice to be cured, and we are striving for that. But as we work on a cure, and even after a cure is available, we need to continue working against stigma.
Stigma is a social issue, and it cannot be cured by research, by biomedical research or treatment of any kind, biomedical treatment. I mean, those aren't going to cure stigma. Stigma is something that we as a community need to continue to work at, both within our own community and also in working with and in educating and collaborating with others across society.
Because when I have cancer, I was able to tell the world out loud, I got cancer. And anybody was caring for me, giving me kisses, oh, love and all that emotion. When I have HIV, I was not able to tell nobody, because if I tell someone, it was hate, it's your fault, it's shame. And why? Why we do that?
After this powerful final message, we conclude the season, HIV from Chaos to Cure. Hope is a scientific fact.
This season was produced by Instituto Saúde Universidade with the support of the Hope Collaboratory. Thank you so much for listening, and please share this episode with your friends and family. This episode was narrated by Vivian Avelino Silva and Raif Durazi. The script was produced by Vivian Avelino Silva and Thomas J. Villa. Bayoki Conteúdo worked on sound edition, and Amanda Ng produced the cover. In this episode, we present testimonials from Monica Gandhi, Stephen Dix, Thomas J. Villa, Alicia Tremel McIntyre, Adam Castillejo, and recordings from CNN and Democracy Now!
This work was supported by the National Institutes of Health under award number UM1AI164559. The content is solely the responsibility of the author and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.